Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason TV. We are in Las Vegas at Freedom Fest, and we are talking to the author George Gilder, certainly one of the more controversial and influential authors of the past 40 years, really. George, thanks for talking with us.
Well, great to be here.
Your latest book is The Israel Test. Right. What is The Israel Test?
The Israel Test is one's response to people who excel you in some field. During the most of the 20th century, the Israel test has been the Jewish test, because Jews created much of world science and technology, won the Second World War through the Manhattan Project.
So the Jews have always punched above their weight, but you're not. This isn't the Jewish test, it's the Israel test.
This is the Israel test. Today, Israel distills the genius of the Jews, and is a vital asset for the United States because it can't afford all the indulgences and debt and crazy green policy and camel phobia, it's born
out of the necessity that Israel is everywhere surrounded by enemies, most of whom won't even acknowledge its right to exist. By the same token, you're a huge free market advocate. Yep. Israel is also a very socialist country.
Reasonably, but it's moved more radically toward the right than virtually any other country in the world. Its current government is a supply side free market operation that operates under the gun, so it has a big defense effort, but it's essentially drastically reduced taxes, tax rates. Mm-hmm. It's deregulated most of its economy. It's deregulated its entire financial sector. It's deregulated its pension system. Mm-hmm. Previously was totally run by the Histadrut, the big public labor union. Now it's yielding $400 million a month into the private sector finance.
What explains domain. Jewish achievement and Israeli achievement?
Well, Jews for centuries have been banished from owning land or even many forms of property and have been driven into intellectual pursuits.
Right.
And they have refined those intellectual pursuits, and now we're in an economy of mind. And the Israelis have adapted to the global economy of mind better than any other ethnic group.
So it's really a kind of cultural evolution. I mean, not necessarily of Jews choosing, but they were forced to, you know, they were kicked out of England, they were kicked out of Spain, they were kicked out of anywhere. And they developed a culture that really privileged education and entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah. And in Israel, of course, they a million Russians who had worked under a communist regime and were virtually prohibited from doing anything material or manufacturing because that was totally socialized. So those guys were forced into software algorithms and mathematics, and a million of them came to Israel and just spurned all the socialist indulgences and fantasies that previously governed Israeli society.
So if that's why they're doing well, how do we adapt that, say, to the United States or to Western Europe or to South America or to China?
Well, elect a supply-side regime.
Yeah.
I mean, Bibi Netanyahu went to MIT and then went and worked for the Boston Consulting Group at the very time it was providing the foundations of supply-side economics.
Supply-side economics is going to make us all a little bit Jewish? What does that mean in terms of, you know, if we've got to get sharper with our minds, how is supply side economics going to? How is that going to step in for thousands of years of cultural evolution?
Because it focuses on the mind. Capitalism is based on kaput, the head. It's the creative form of economics. It focuses on what makes human beings unique, rather than our common prurient interests mm-hmm. and morbid fears and anxieties. It focuses on our curiosities and aspirations and creativity. And creativity always comes as a surprise to us. And so it can't be planned.
Well, one of the things, you know, speaking about supply side economics, you wrote Wealth and Poverty, which is generally considered the Bible of the supply side economics. It emerged in the late 70s as a major bestseller, mm-hmm. major influence on Ronald Reagan's economic mm-hmm. policies. Part of what you talked about in that book is how entrepreneurs are part of a gift economy. I mean, you helped revive the Marcel Mauss idea of the gift economy. Talk a little bit about that, and do you still believe that?
Yeah, sure. Entrepreneurs have to invest. They have to give. They have to create before there's any assured response to their creations. Mm-hmm. There's no demand for new innovations. If you could demand innovation, you wouldn't. Socialism would work.
It's a fallacy, and we saw this with the iPad and the iPod and the iPhone before that. People saying like, oh, of course everybody wants the iPad. We've always wanted it, but in fact, there was no demand for the iPad.
That's right, and that's true about all innovations. That's mm-hmm. why. Supply side, by unleashing individual creativity, creates wealth and progress, now, and all other systems suppress wealth and progress.
But now let's talk about supply side economics, because that's in, you know, supply side economics and Starve the Beast kind of got commingled in a way that I think has tarnished supply side economics
I had nothing to do with Starve the
Beast. Right, but let's explain what you're saying.
I think it is a beast, and it should be starved. But one of my insights mm-hmm. that I saw was the best way to measure the success of tax policy is how much government spending rises. Mm-hmm. And countries with low or declining tax rates increase their government spending three times as fast as governments with high or rising tax rates. And that's because they grow six times faster.
Right.
That means government is growing smaller as a part of a bigger economy.
But government has more money to spend, though, in absolute terms.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of your other books, because for me, as a longtime reader of your work, you know, it seems that your books get split into a kind of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde approach, where there are books that are about social issues, where you're a pretty rock-rib social conservative. Books like Sexual Suicide or Invisible Man, Visible Man, excuse me, and the revision of Sexual Suicide as Men and Marriage, and then there are the books that are pretty utopian, and we can argue whether or not they're utopian or they're descriptive. But things like Life After Television, Telecosm, and whatnot. And you were one of Wired's great original poster boys, cover boys. How do you square Sexual Suicide, for instance, argued in the early 70s in response to a kind of breaking down of traditional gender roles, that we were going to destroy our society. And yet then you were also later promulgating a kind of series of technologies that would allow us both to indulge our wildest fantasies but reconfigure ourselves almost independent of bodies. Do you see a conflict or a tension in your work? So how do you square those circles?
It's just the family is critical to raising civilized, creative, responsible people who can exploit freedom and enjoy freedom and fulfill themselves in freedom.
How are you defining the family in that sense?
The nuclear family, man and woman and children is
so
the
where,
nuclear
So how do you feel about New York legalizing gay marriage? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a bad thing. I don't.
Why is it a bad thing?
I mean, gays can do what they want to do, but I don't believe that, now bisexuality is supposedly a factor. If the fact is all of us are bisexual in various ways, it's this whole idea that that homosexuality resembles race in any respect is nonsense. The whole idea that male homosexuality resembles lesbianism in any respect is nonsense. And so this whole idea marriage is just a parody. It's an absurd concept.
But do you think that two gay men who are married, would they be able to create a stable family situation that would raise children who would be flourish or be creative?
Sure. Yeah. Individuals can do all kinds of things. Right. It's different when you're establishing principles that are going to govern the society. Yeah. And the chief problem with gay marriage, to me, I don't particularly care what they choose to do, but the result will be teaching young kids that gay sex is just as good as any other sex, which is...
Now, have you ever had gay sex? Do you know is it as good? Or?
I know enough. I've spent a long time studying this subject, and I know about gay sex more than most of the people who talk about it with such authority. And it's not... It is not procreative. It cannot sustain the race. Young boys are quite responsive to it, and so it's a mistake to open this door for confused boys who have yet to crystallize their sexual orientation. And it's an addictive form of behavior. And recent studies show that until about 21, our brains are very responsive to various forms of addiction. And the earlier they're inculcated, the more
gay predisposition is really a learned behavior.
Gayness is about 50% genetic, like everything else, like alcoholism, any kind of behavior of this sort is, as shown by twin studies, about 50% genetic, and the other 50% is environment and choice and will.
Don't you think that 50% of twin studies are just complete BS, though?
Twin studies are about the best access we can get to these forms of causation.
To shift to the other emphasis in your work about the kind of ways in which technology, are transformative. In Life After Television, you essentially foresaw not the internet per se, it existed, but the flourishing of
The World Wide Web of glass and light, about.
Yeah, when you were in discussing
before
telecomputers.
The World Wide Web.
Has it paid off on your vision that it was going to reinvigorate? I mean, I remember reading that book, and one of the things that was fascinating is that you anticipated the arguments that this was going to atomize people or push people apart. And in fact, you were saying that it would help to create new forms of community, but also invigorate traditional forms. Do you feel that has been borne out?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It creates a huge new avenue for all forms of human expression.
And that's a good thing.
And that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, and the medium.
I'm libertarian. I don't.
If the web is inherently libertarian, or it's a decentralized mechanism or framework or grammar that allows us to speak a different language, I mean, are we already in a libertarian world, though?
We are. Yeah. That is true. That is the impact. It overcomes the tyranny of broadcast, top-down, hierarchical. Cultural systems.
Do you miss the days when you could feel secure that not only you but everybody else had seen Walter Cronkite speaking the news?
I've never had a TV in my home all my life, so I have no idea Walter Cronkite.
What do you think?
I hardly know what he looks like.
What do you think explains the nostalgia that you find among many conservatives, but perhaps more surprisingly among many liberals or leftists, for that day when people were not as free to express themselves?
They want the comforts of bland and uncreative society.
What do you think is, I mean, you anticipated the impact of the World Wide Web. You talked about
I said it would lead to a golden age of text.
Yeah.
And it did.
Certainly true, yeah. Forget the Gutenberg galaxy. Yeah. I mean, we're living in it now.
I think, yeah.
So what do you anticipate, or what do you see as the next huge transformative kind of technological development?
I think that every Moore's Law means that every 10 years there's a complete transformation of computer architecture. Mm-hmm. And the change that's emerging is cloud computing, mm-hmm. and which means that anybody anywhere can have access to total supercomputer capabilities, mm-hmm. or even trans supercomputer, ultra computer capabilities. And I've got a company in Los Angeles called OTOY that is won several Academy Awards, mm-hmm. for its light stage technology, but also is building the world's fastest computer out of clusters of graphics processors, and that can be a petaflop machine anywhere around the world, and which can mean that your teleputer can, or your, which is your smartphone,
right,
as
right.
they call it, can do anything that a supercomputer can, mm-hmm. do.
Are you're optimistic about the future?
Yes.
Yeah. So what are the things that can ruin the future for us?
Well, we got an absolutely stupid third-worldly president at the moment who wants to reduce the United States to some third-world backwater.
And when really you say that way, I mean, how do you mean?
In response to the upper-class intellectuals who have paled over with a cast of green goo, and I think the environmental movement and the effort to suppress all energy production is virtually vandalistic, mm-hmm. and so I think this is the worst president I've ever seen.
Okay,
why
do you call him
movement.
Third worldly, though? I mean, because he wants to bring us down to the level.
Yeah,
or
does yeah, he
does. Does he want to, or is it that will be the effect you're saying?
I think.
I mean, does he hate America, or is he just misguided?
He resents capitalism. He resents the wealth that capitalism generates. He resents the inequalities that are indispensable to any creative and free society, and
what do you base that on, other than the way that you see his policies working?
Is that
a psycho history or a psychobiography?
Well, it's just evident to me. I mean, he studied with Edward Said, and Rashid Khalidi was his press secretary. Reverend Wright was his preacher. Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn were his pals and intellectual.
Will that win
out? He just is a hardcore leftist. That's what he is. And he may escape it. He may transcend it as he proceeds. But so far, he's totally failed. I mean, what he's doing to the U.S. energy economy today is, couldn't be done by a nuclear attack. I mean, it's devastating and destructive, and he's got to be thrown out as a result of this.
Do you see anybody, within the Republican Party, or not even that? I mean, even in the Democratic Party, or who are the people who are making the right counter arguments to this? Because it's not like, I can't imagine that anybody on the Republican side of the aisle is inspiring you to say, yeah, they're really getting the next generation of technology or the next generation.
I think any of the Republicans are a lot better. I mean,
yeah.
If Newt wasn't such a jerk, he's the smartest and has the
best ideas.
Well,
what happened
ideas.
To him? Because he was obviously somebody he heavily influenced
People,
by you.
These polls is demand side transcribed into politics. You're constantly looking at a rearview mirror. So there are two really destructive forces in our politics, and one is polls, which reduces everybody to a blithering idiot and following polls. And the other is our campaign finance laws that currently allow special interest groups to spend any amount they want, but reduce individuals who actually are real entities in politics to $2,000 a campaign. Yeah. And this is a major factor in our politics. And the combination of polls and special interests has what has really brought our current system to its current plight.
Final question. You described yourself as a libertarian. What's the basic right fit for government? What should it be doing? Well,
they've got a defense and law, upholding the law. You do need a structure of law in order to have a free economy.
Right. But
information theory is what I'm really working on more than anything else these days. And it shows that you need a low entropy carrier, that is with no surprises, to bear high entropy creations. This comes from telecommunications analysis, Claude Shannon's vision of telecommunications, but it applies across the board. So you need regularities in the law in order to unleash creativity and enterprise.
So should the government be engaging social issues the way that it does, or should that be something that is hashed out in the marketplace of ideas and of lifestyle?
Yes, it should be hashed out in the marketplace of ideas rather than having government. I think laws about marriage make sense. But the limited set of laws are desirable. And the real cancer of capitalism is when lawyers start manipulating the law in order to favor litigation and conflict and enrich lawyers.
Well, George Gilder, I want to thank you very much for talking to Reason TV. Your latest book, his latest book is The Israel Test, and hopefully we'll all pass that with flying colors.
I hope so. It's important.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.